It's been an incredible day with lots of diversity of topics and ideas. Our last speaker is Dana Royer, who received his PhD here in 2002 with advisors Bob Berner and Leo Hickey. He has, at least to my knowledge, the distinction of finishing his PhD in the shortest amount of time that I'm aware of in recent memory, in just 3.5 years. So that's the standard by which I hold all my grad students. And to which none of them has yet lived up. However, we are going to hear about what Dana has been working on recently at Wesleyan University, just up the road, on high climate sensitivity during an ancient greenhouse.
Okay, so my goal is to finish before it gets dark here. I'm partly responsible for the sort of mixed salad character of this session. I was initially going to present something much more biological, but I became quite taken in the recent months with what I want to present here, and so I've run with this. My focus is going to be what is the quantitative relationship between CO2 and temperature during the early Eocene. So this is, as many of you know, the acme of Cenozoic warmth, the longest or the warmest long-lived period of warmth since the demise of the dinosaurs, and I think this has implications for thinking about ancient climate dynamics and potentially also for future climate scenarios. Most of what I'll present is not my own work, and I've thought a fair bit about it, but there's certainly it's not firmed up, and for those reasons, I thought it was quite appropriate to present here. And if memory serves me right, if you don't agree with me, you're going to tell me, right? And this, I'll come back to the Arctic at the end, so that's not just a filler, a first slide filler. This goes back to my dissertation. This is sort of the core of what I did, which was to present or create a CO2 record based on stomatal distributions in some fossil plants. And we focused on two critical intervals, the early Paleogene and the middle Miocene. These are both periods of known global warmth. And what was perhaps most surprising from this study was we were getting CO2 estimates not particularly higher than the present day levels. And so this suggests that in addition to CO2, there must have been other radiative forcings important at these two times. But when you put this in the context of what else was known with other CO2 estimates, and I want to emphasize, because I'm going to do a follow-up to this. This is early 2000s. This is what we saw. The Neogene looked quite nice. Everybody's agreeing with one another. But the Paleogene is just, it's a cloud. It's a cone of information. And so, you know, pick what you want, right? Either everybody's right or nobody's right. It wasn't entirely sure. My estimates are the yellow data near the bottom there, and I felt I did a quite good job of trying to accommodate the various factors that could also influence what I was measuring. But everybody else is doing the same as well. And I have to say there have been some people, for example, that boron record who have presented, CO2 is very high during the Paleogene, and they would cite the boron estimates. But bear in mind that there's lots of other contextual data suggesting that that's not necessarily true. And in fact, in the case of the boron record, that had been revised in 2003, I think, to much lower values. But people still use this earlier record, so have a bit of a chip on my shoulder about that. But since this time, in my opinion, the early Paleogene record has changed quite a lot. And so this is what I see now for the whole Cenozoic. And so what's how it departs from what I just showed you is that the early part of the record, the Paleogene, we're actually, for the first time, seeing some structure to that curve. So we're seeing some structure, and most importantly, those high numbers are going away. Now, I know that there are at least a few people in this room intensely interested in paleo CO2, and I don't want to bore everybody else with the details, but up there on top of those bullets are the major revisions that have happened since that first plot that I showed you, and I'd be happy to go over the details of that later. But for now, I'll just continue on with this record. So we see this, what is kind of a hump-shaped pattern. So, of course, an interesting question to ask. So this is CO2. What was temperature during this period? And many of you know the general story here. As all Cenozoic paleoclimate talks must do, they show the benthic foraminifer record from Zekos, a wonderful record, wonderful compilation, warming towards the top on the vertical axis. And so you see there's the period of sustained Cenozoic warmth centered around 55 to 50 million years ago. And if you compare that to CO2, sort of first order, at least relative to the first plot I showed you, there's, I think, a better correspondence here. It's not perfect. There are, as you move towards the end of the Eocene, some estimates, including from Mark Bagani here, suggesting that CO2 remained fairly high despite temperatures starting to cool off. Although I will remark that the stomatal records, which are in green, probably show the best fit to the Zekos curve. And also the other discrepancy perhaps is during the Paleocene, where we have a drop in CO2 and also a cooling, but the magnitude of the drop in CO2 seems larger than that from the temperature. But what we can now start to do is think about quantitatively climate sensitivity, which I'm defining here as the amount of warming we would expect with a CO2 doubling. And for some of these time slices, we know a fair bit about what global mean surface temperature may have been. You know, the benthic record is reflecting the deep ocean, which is the largest reservoir of heat on the surface Earth. So it's giving you some sense of global surface temperature, but it's probably more of a refraction. And so there are other, you know, surface temperature approaches which are probably more appropriate. And of course, there's been a lot of study for the Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum, which is right between the Paleocene and Eocene 55 million years ago. So we have a good sense of the baseline temperature before that event at the very end of the Paleocene, which is probably about 5 degrees warmer than today, or I should say relative to pre-industrial temperatures. And now the CO2 record's a bit, there's some scatter there, and so you could certainly argue where should we suggest CO2, what was CO2 at that time. I'm picking sort of a mid-range estimate of 560 ppm. And if you just do very simple calculation for climate sensitivity that for doubling of CO2, you would expect a 6-degree warming. If CO2 were lower, that of course would rise, that would amplify the climate sensitivity to higher numbers. If we move on to the peak of Cenozoic warmth 52 million years ago, CO2 does seem to be somewhat higher. I put it at 800 ppm. Global mean surface temperature is 8 degrees warmer, perhaps even up to 10 degrees warmer than pre-industrial. And so the rise in temperature outstrips the rise in CO2, and the climate sensitivity increases a bit more. And so how does this put this in the context of what we know about climate sensitivity? As I'm sure most of you are aware of, the IPCC, which has involved hundreds of scientists, hundreds of studies, mainly based on the present-day Earth and the near-present-day Earth, a climate sensitivity of about 3 degrees C. Now, of course, there's a fair bit of scatter, but the peak probability typically centers around 3 degrees centigrade. So what we're finding here is perhaps double that number. Now, myself and Bob Berner and Jeff Park a couple years ago presented a single average for the whole Phanerozoic, the last 420 million years of climate sensitivity, and we got a peak probability of about 3 degrees, 2.8 degrees centigrade to be exact. So that matched quite closely what the IPCC style estimates were. So what we're, if everybody is correct here, what this is suggesting is that during this time slice of extreme global warmth, it was a period of above the background of 3 degrees C, we had this peak of about 6 degrees centigrade. And indeed, if we move off that peak, and this is perhaps the most fuzzy calculation, I'm just looking at the symmetry of the temperature record and suggesting that at this time, moving into the middle Eocene, climate was about 5 degrees warmer than today, just as it was 55 million years ago. But CO2 is still high, or maybe even rising a bit, and so the climate sensitivity is around 3 degrees C, so we're starting to see that 3-degree number again. And I'll just mention, I had a master's student, Gabriela Doria, who I think is in the audience here, who's now here at Yale, who estimated CO2 at 40 million years ago, and our estimated climate sensitivity from that study was also 3 degrees centigrade. So there might be this pattern emerging of a background climate sensitivity of about 3 degrees C, but during the early Eocene, something does seem to be different. And so that's what I want to continue on with here. But what we see here, first order, is that global temperatures does seem to scale with climate sensitivity. Now, there was this study about a month ago published in Nature, which are shown in the top, which is that blue record. But I want to take a half a step back and first look at those tropical records of temperature. These are sea surface temperatures. The red data are from TEX-86, as is that high latitude blue record. And the green record, tropical site, is from calcium-magnesium ratios, which might be the least certain of the two methods. But we see tropical temperatures quite warm. And as probably many of you know, 10 years ago, the dogma was that during these ancient greenhouses, tropical temperatures weren't much different than today. They may have even been cooler. And this led to this idea of a cool tropical paradox, which tied everybody up in knots, because it was hard to understand how the climate system operated when the Earth was globally warmer than today with cooler tropical temperatures. But that whole idea has kind of slid into the dustbin, so to speak. Most pristine temperature records today from the tropics in the last few years for these ancient greenhouses are getting quite warm temperatures. But what's remarkable is that this most recent high latitude reconstruction, you could see restricted to that early Eocene climatic optimum, the latitudinal temperature gradient almost collapses completely. Now this is kind of boggling to think about it. 65 degrees south paleolatitude, sea surface temperatures of 30 degrees centigrade. And so this suggests, if correct, a very flat latitudinal temperature gradient. And at first order, you can't get there with just CO2, because CO2 is globally mixed. Now, there is going to be some amplification due to CO2 at high latitudes, the temperatures, but you can't get a temperature gradient this flat from just CO2 alone. And so it suggests that during this period, we might even call anomalous period of the early Eocene climatic optimum, something very fundamentally different is happening. The climate system was different. Just to reinforce that it's not just that one data set. This is now, instead of looking through time per se, it's looking at three discrete time slices, but now overlaying latitude. This is from that same paper. This is the Utrecht group. And the Tasman Rise plateau data set I just presented is marked there, and the Tanzania data set is marked with the letter G. But you could see during that period that encompasses that climatic optimum, that sort of tannish curve, very flat temperature gradient. And then as you move to the present day, yes, the tropical temperatures are declining, but more strongly, the high latitude temperatures are starting to decline very strongly. The present day gradient is shown in black. Now, climate models, of course, have been very important for us thinking about these ancient climate dynamics. But a critical problem is that these models do not do well at replicating what the data suggest. And this in green is what most people consider the most current sort of state-of-the-art. This is the NCAR model tuned to the early Eocene. And you can see, well, even in the tropics, it's not doing very, very good. But certainly in the high latitudes, you would probably grade that an F. And so this is, I would say, the biggest understatement here, this title, that the climate models are missing something. I'll also mention that the emergent climate sensitivity in this particular model is 2 degrees centigrade. And so you can get, in the tropics anyway, you can make up some of that difference if you do ramp up that climate sensitivity to, say, 6 degrees C. But even just that is not going to do it. CO2 alone is not going to do it, because you're not going to match those high latitude temperatures. And so what I'll finish with here is just a series of bullets here. Our task here is, how do we warm those high latitudes? So We can't explain the whole situation with any radiative forcing that impacts the entire globe, like CO2, methane, and so on. There's been some exciting work in the area of clouds, and we've heard this. We've heard about clouds all day, and how there's a lot of work to be done in that area, and a lot of exciting areas of development. That's also true in the paleoclimate world. There's been a suggestion that with warm, ice-free oceans, you might have more vigorous high-latitude convection, which would lead to more stratospheric clouds, and which would have a net warming. And so that would be a regional signal. Perhaps also, step back, just a half a step here. What the biggest difference moving from the Eocene to the present day is you move from a world that's draped in forests to a world at the high latitudes to a world that's draped in ice. And so we're going to have forests, we're going to have swamps, and likely there's going to be increased methane fluxes from those polar swamps, and there's been some suggestion that that could lead to an increase in polar stratospheric clouds, which would cause warming, at least during the winter time. Although this particular study was more of a prescriptive study, and follow-up studies have not been able to, from the ground up, from first principles, sort of replicate the mechanism for this. And lastly, under clouds, this would be more of a global effect, but in a more pristine Earth, we've probably been overestimating the density of the cloud condensation nuclei. And if we had fewer of those nuclei, you'd have thinner clouds, which would lead to a drop in albedo. Potentially also vegetation feedbacks. I'm biased towards plants, and so this is an area of interest to me. You have now the poles forested, and one aspect of that is they're going to be emitting things such as volatile organic compounds, which could lead to warming. If it does lead to the formation of aerosols, that could also lead to a cooling, so the jury is still out there. And finally, and this is also more of a global, would it be more of a global impact? It would still imply a temperature gradient, but perhaps an enhanced hydrologic cycle. And people have spoken, there's been some thought about increase in hypercanes, these gigantic hurricanes that would help transfer heat to the higher latitudes. And so this is, those of you who follow this topic, people have been thinking about this for 20 years, ever since the origin of GCMs. And there's been some interesting wrinkles here. And what I've tried to do here is snap CO2 into this context, because now for the first time I feel we have a better understanding of what CO2 levels were in the atmosphere at this time. I'll finish there.
Thank you, Dana. We are doing reasonably